Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you. Well, welcome everybody. I feel like I'm learning new steps of how to make things show up where I want them to show up every time I turn around. So I'm going to pop up here as we get started, if I can find it. Oh, I can't find it. Hang on a second. I had to unlearn one of the things I learned. Okay, there. Okay, now we're here. Okay, so if I did that right, can you see the list of agreements that we talked through last week?
Yes.
Ooh, excellent, good. That means next time I show you something, you'll be able to see that too. As we dive farther into the 21-day equity challenge, I wanted to just kind of put back there in front of ourselves the ways that we decided we wanted to talk about this, the ways that we want to work with each other as we are sharing about equity here. So we're going to listen to each other. We're going to keep these conversations within the group. So this is not it's not strictly a confidential group, but we're gonna remember that this kind of conversation that we want to have here it allows us to kind of dig into things that we may not have the same kind of conversation even with each other in a different setting. So we want to make sure that we're safe in that way. We want to respect each other's opinions, understand each other's opinions. When we don't understand each other's opinions, ask. When we hear somebody else say something that we think, oh, that cannot be the way you're supposed to say that, we're going to assume positive intent in what was said identify, okay, here's the piece of this that was offensive or upsetting or bothered me. So that we can learn together how we want to relate. So those were our agreements. I'm going to then ask if folks, I know we had some, a couple of people who had trouble last week with receiving the emails from the 21-day equity challenge. Has anybody still not been able to receive an email? So you're all, Warren?
I was not sure that I got all 7 consecutive this week, but unless they maybe ended up in my junk mail and I deleted them. But did anybody get a few, but maybe not all 7?
Yeah, I don't think you should have 7.
You should have a total of 6 now.
Okay.
It's only the weekdays. So today was day 6.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Okay. That
makes sense. Come about, what, about 7 in the morning?
Okay.
Okay. So do you have 5 or 6?
I think maybe I can find 3.
Okay.
I'm just, there's so much junk mail. I've given up going through it, but if they're coming through, I don't think it went to junk mail. I'm okay.
Okay.
Warren, I had some of mine came in on my primary and some of them came in on promotions.
Right. Mine did that too. So I've had to search for 21 day equity and then they all show up. So I'm not finding them easily. But I do a search for them each day.
And, you know, if you go to the Equity Challenge website, You can click on the day and it has, excuse me, has all the information there, even if you're not signed up. So I caught up on my back ones, even though I didn't have the emails.
Yeah, so that's another way into it. If you can get to one email and click at the very top where it says, see this in a browser, and then just bookmark that, you can get from there to any of the other days. You can't get to future days. They appear one by one, but so you can go there and get it from the website if you feel like you missed anything. So
okay.
All right, let me see if I can show you one here. I'll pull one up and show you what we mean. And dun, dun. Okay, so I'm going to show you this is today's email.
Okay.
And so at the top of the email, it has this visit day 6 on the Equity Challenge website.
Okay.
And if you click on that, I'm going to have to show you the next screen there. Am I on the 21-Day Equity Challenge website now? Excellent. So here it says day 6, wealth and income, but it's got the calendar down here as well.
Okay.
So you can hop from there to any other day.
Very good.
So that's your other way into it. And you can just bookmark that page once you get to it, and that'll give you the chance to see it from there.
Thank you.
You betcha. The things you didn't realize you would learn in contemporary issues. Okay. So we had a week about race and racism this week. Any topics or presentations that particularly caught your attention this week? Because we can go a variety of different directions. I have a direction in mind, but I am open to directions that you may want to go. What caught your attention?
The only thing I would say is that I am reading the book Caste. I'm about 3/4 of the way through. And, you know, it parallels this. A lot of things say the same thing, basically.
So resonating with information you're picking up elsewhere. Yeah.
Well, I did take advantage of Deb Kellogg's tip on that one video to be sure and watch. So I was able to, through her email, get into that video. I watched that.
Yeah. What did you think of that video?
Enlightening. You know, I had never had that explained to me in all these years. Never. A lot of stuff hadn't been explained on further thought.
That's good. I'm glad that was able to sort of open up understanding of that for you.
Yeah.
Good.
I was amazed that we didn't always talk about race, that wasn't a thing until a certain period of time. And then it became about skin color, but it wasn't always that way. I thought that was kind of intriguing, that wasn't a given the way it is today.
Yeah, that the idea of race came from somewhere. Yeah.
Nathan, I have kind of resolved to try not to dominate or put in too much this week. Do you want me to say anything about the email I sent to you?
You are welcome to. I think there's a solid connection there between what Deb just said and that email.
Yeah.
Deb and Pam sent their emails to everybody. John sent his just to me.
Yeah, just as an idea for a place to go. I wasn't so much trying to tell everybody else anything. I said that from prior things I have studied, I find that just as it wasn't always color that we grouped around to discriminate, and as we are now learning that it can be anything, that there seems to be something in human nature that makes us all want to find some way to not be on the bottom of the heap and preferably be on the top of the heap and feel better than the outgroup over in the next village.
So the idea there being that that when human groups get into antagonistic relationships with each other, the power imbalances that can be part of that happen, and then the ideas of race are one of the ways that those power imbalances have been used, That piece was really interesting to me, and that's where I would have us go. As Deb lifted up the idea that that race came from somewhere, came from some when, and the one of the I think the clearest sort of moments of that in the materials for this week was the Seeing White podcast. And I should know his name, but at any rate, the speaker was saying, okay, you know, I wanted to, as a white person, he wanted to figure out, you know, sort of what do white people need to know and do about race? And he said, so, you know, where did the idea of whiteness come from? And he said, I didn't realize I was going to get such a simple, straightforward answer. He asked the historian Ibram Kendi, who has written a 600-page book on where race came from. He said, I did not expect him to have a single name, but he had a single name from the about the 14th century as Portugal was beginning to expand its colonial ambitions. One of the things that human groups have done throughout history is enslave other humans, humans from within the group, humans from other groups. So enslavement has happened over and over again throughout history. But, The thing that changed in the 14th century in Portugal was that Gomes Zurara invented race as a justification for enslaving people. Prince Henry the Navigator wanted some PR for his new program of going to Africa, picking people up and enslaving them. And in the process, devastating some of the most advanced civilizations that had to that point existed on Earth. And so Zurara said, okay, I can write you a leaflet on that. And essentially wrote as PR material the idea of race. And the idea of race as the sort of principle that we Europeans are, you know, nobler and more advanced, and those people, in this instance, those Africans, are somehow either backwards or corrupt or sinful, or these ideas have morphed over time. And that's what Kendi's book, Stamped from the Beginning, does. That is not a 15-minute a day read. But it's an excellent book, just laying out kind of in, you know, just tireless detail where racism came from. And Kendi's point is that racism exists to legitimate and prop up power imbalances. And so if you want to get rid of racism, you have to fix the power imbalances. So there's a piece of the conversation that the host of the podcast, John Biewen, he calls up his friend Chenjerai and asks him, okay, what do I need to know to understand this? And so they have a conversation here. I'm going to invite us to listen to a podcast together. So this is not great television, but I want to invite you to just listen with me for about 9 minutes to this conversation between John and Chenjerai, so that Chenjerai can tell us what we white people need to know and understand about race. Incidentally, there is a long and ongoing pattern of white people asking black people to explain race to us. And that's not their job. They've got enough work to do. It's our job to learn about race. So I'm very grateful that Chenjerai is willing to have this conversation with his friend John, because then we get to learn a lot from it too. But as a disclaimer there, Chenjerai was not obligated to say this to us, but he did, and I'm glad. So here he is. So the conversation kind of began at that weird disconnect, or sort of a maybe a catch-22 in the way that we learn about race, kind of now that we have the Human Genome Project and we have the idea, the understanding that race is invented, right? That scientifically there's no meaningful basis for race at a genetic level. But because we have, you know, we've spent 600 years learning that there's a scientific basis for race, that if we suddenly learn that there is no scientific basis for race as a biological thing, then it's tempting for us to then say, well, then race is unreal in a way that means we don't have to pay any attention to it anymore. The point that's being made here is that race still exists socially. Just because humans made it doesn't mean it's not real. It just means that humans made it. So when we say race is not real, we mean that there's no meaningful genetic basis for it. When we say that race is real, what do we mean by that?
I think we get into a lot of the bias the day that we talked and read and had resources about bias.
Mm-hmm.
When I was teaching, my class for the first time became more diverse, other than families who lived in Country Club, West Des Moines. The Bosnian War began, and we suddenly had a lot of Bosnian children in our class who came usually from Bosnia to a refugee camp. They didn't seem to stay in the refugee camp as long as kids who came later in my teaching experience. But if there was thunder, they crawled under their desk and started crying, and you were trying to figure out what their experience had been when they literally lived in a neighborhood that looked a lot like Clive in Bosnia before the war began. It was very much a suburb. and what happened here should never have happened. And you find that out the more you learn about people, that they're more like you than unlike you. But as my classroom became more diverse and we started having a lot of Hispanic families move in, and then African American communities move in, but most of them weren't African American. They were Nigerian and they were from other countries in Africa. And it just got more and more diverse in the last 15 years of my teaching. And no matter how much I talk to the kids about equality and we're all the same and find our commonalities, my classroom was great in the classroom, but every day when we lined up for recess, I had the 5 Bosnian kids in line together and the 3 Asian kids in line together and the 2 Black kids in line together and the kids that lived in country club all lined up together. And I didn't line them up that way. It happened every day. And I would come home and say to Perry, I don't understand. I'm trying so hard to make it a classroom of equality and it's not working. And he said, you know, biology of animals, we all know to stick to our kind for safety, for to keep us alive. And we're always going to do that no matter how educated we get. The first thing is an instinctual thing of finding people that have commonalities with you. So some of this we're not ever going to get over, but the only way we can try is by educating ourselves and doing things like this to understand and learn more and be able to see people differently.
So, I'm hearing in there the frustrating reality of people are going to find ways to sort themselves and each other. And where does that tendency to sort ourselves and each other, what does that have to do with this difference that doesn't exist? This racial difference that doesn't actually exist.
Friends, only because of the ground rules we agreed to earlier on, I'm going to say a few things that probably I wouldn't normally say.
You're about to take a chance on us.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
And there's a song in South Pacific where this nurse realizes this man from France has had children with a native woman. And I think the phrase, and help me if I go, you've got to be carefully taught. I think that's in South Pacific. Well, my dad's been gone 32 years. My mom's been gone 21 years. And they were wonderful parents and did what they thought was appropriate. But especially my dad, in his own way, conveyed to me what he thought was appropriate and inappropriate. And this is in Marshall County, Marshalltown, then later on out on an acreage. But anyway, central Iowa. And all my relatives came out of Western Europe, settled in the Midwest, you know, so I'd never had anybody in the Deep South. And I keep thinking about that lyric in South Pacific that I picked up a lot of my biases, ideas on those that didn't look like me from my parents. Milo and Elsie. And, you know, I was born in 43, so you take the 50s, it was a very influential decade where I'm trying to figure out stuff. And then finally, when I left home and got into college, did I really get exposed to a wider variety of students. They weren't all, you know, like me in Nevada, Iowa, or Marshalltown, Iowa, you know. And little would he know that he now has 3 granddaughters, great-granddaughters, that are half African-American and half Caucasian. And he also has another grandson who has married a His wife is Jewish, and their two children are being raised in the Jewish religion. And for a Protestant Methodist out of Central Iowa, was that four generations, three generations? Yeah, four generations later, we've got, at the Pitcher family reunions, we've got three, well, two are in college, and black great-great-granddaughters, and two, a son, and a grandson and a granddaughter that are Jewish. So I think with time, the Pitcher family has been able to, you know, the sky didn't fall. We still seem to enjoy each other at family reunions. But my father, I don't know that he would have been able to comprehend what his family would look like. He only had three children. I'm the middle one of three in 2020. But it can. Those transitions can happen. And I'm not saying that it needs to be that personal, but it sure as hell helps on your acceptance of new ideas when it's that close to you.
It's a mind-opening experience, isn't it?
Yeah. And sometimes I'm just thinking, how did this happen? These two boys, that one married the Jewish lady and one married the black lady, they lived in a little town in Illinois. Their dad is a veterinarian, you know? And they, in their life, were able to diversify and not follow as you might have expected. So that's just a little, I think Russ and Mary may have known some of that, but probably the rest of you weren't aware that I had that we have in the Pitcher family, some diversity. And when I went to Africa, some of you may have remembered, I did make a point to go to Cape Town because my nephew and his wife, and at that time, three younger daughters, were living in Cape Town. And his parents, that's a long hike, it's 15 hours or more, and saw them in their home, and they're translating the Bible into lots of different African dialects. And I can't remember the name of the firm or the organization, but like I say, it's just amazing what could happen without any planning. Just it evolved over four generations. You've got to be carefully taught, and see, and I was taught incorrectly, but I was taught.
We learn this stuff, yeah. And there is hope that we can unlearn it. Can I zoom out from the sort of the direct personal experience? I think the direct personal experience matters. And one of the ways that it matters is that it should disprove a lot of what we otherwise would have learned about race and racism. We have sort of an idea that racism is just a thing you have, right? And it's a thing individual people have. And as good judgmental humans, we tend to assume that someone is racist and that sort of defines them, right? And sometimes, you know, we construct that in ways like the difference between the North and the South. I didn't call you on that, but I disagree. I don't think that you weren't worrying about the South. So it wasn't important for your story, but the idea that racism is worse in the South than it is in the North of the United States. A lot of black people I know will say that's not their experience. It's just more overt in one place than in another. But again, that's still talking about racism as the idea of an attitude that just exists in somebody. And it does. Racism is an attitude, and a set of cognitive biases but it's also something else. And John and Chandrai spent some time on that. The idea that racism is, it's not just about what we think. But when Chandrai was saying race is real, even though it's fake, even though it's not biologically real, it's socially real. And it's socially real in the sense that you can measure it. You can measure racism in, he said, it predicts wealth accumulation. It predicts rates of police killings. It predicts life expectancy. It predicts health outcomes. It predicts access to schools, which is not to say that it's biologically real, right? But it is to say that as a social structure, it is also there. And the critical point that they were referencing Ibram Kendi, who is also interviewed on that podcast. We just skipped his part. So if you want to hear from him directly, you can do that. But his really critical point is that the mental attitudes that we often call racism, those were carefully taught. You're absolutely right, Warren. The mental attitudes have to be carefully taught, and the thing that they exist for, the reason they were developed, is in order to justify power imbalances that are still in place. They have, they've morphed and changed over the years, but that there are power imbalances still in place that play themselves out in relationships with law enforcement, that play themselves out in access to wealth, access to education, that play themselves out powerfully in health outcomes, life expectancy, morbidity, some of those are disease specific, but these things are predicted by race in ways that are not explainable any other way. They're not predicted by genetic variation in in certain risk factors. They're not even predicted by income. That's one of our other sort of our common kind of dodges. When we want to pretend that racism isn't as big an issue as it is, we'll say, race is just sort of masking an economic inequity. But some of the other materials pointed out for us that if you look at home borrowing, mortgage lending, a Black borrower of middle to high income and good credit score will more often be turned down for a loan than a white borrower with less income and a poorer credit score. So these inequities are all throughout the system and don't necessarily even depend on individual attitudes. And that's hard because I want to be good and I want my being good to fix it. And so we have to root out these attitudes and we have to see these systemic biases that, nobody even has to think it's a good idea for it to exist.
I keep coming back to the idea that such biases, using your word, aren't only expressed by and about race. This didn't happen very much to me because I had an extraordinary set of parents, but I heard it had happened with other kids, that they would be told, oh, you can't play with that family. They're just not like us. And then the kids would have to ask why. And maybe the answer would be they're Catholic, or maybe the answer would be they work at the cement plant. Or it could be almost anything, but they're just not like us. Race seems to be a subset of ways to define ourselves as being not like them. And I'm thinking tonight, and I wish I'd gone and reread it, about the Dr. Seuss book about the star-bellied Sneetches. And I can't remember enough about all of that, but the idea is there are two tribes who are different only in that one tribe has stars on their bellies and the other doesn't. I wish I'd reread that.
Yeah, I think
for
you're
me,
right.
For me, there wasn't anybody that wasn't white, even though I grew up on the south side of Chicago. Everybody in my area, and Chicago is not a warm city to walk into. People tend to stay in their subgroups, and everybody lives, certain nationalities live in this area. But my neighborhood was Irish Catholic, and I was Protestant, and I couldn't go to my friends' churches. Or no, I could go to my friends' churches, but they couldn't come to my church. So they were more than willing to teach their religion to me. But by golly, I was a pagan religion and they couldn't come to my church. And I grew up with that all until college, where I really met other people of other races and religions. Everybody around me was Irish Catholic, except for the people in my church. I'm sure there must have been another church that was Protestant, but I didn't know of them. All my friends went to the Catholic church and Catholic school, and it was just very Irish Catholic. So it's not always skin color. It's any issue different from whatever that core group is in the area you're in.
I went to a high school in a small town, population of about 1,000. There were 22 in my graduating class. So I didn't know any black people, but that town had 6 churches. Presbyterian and Methodist and Lutheran and Catholic, and the Catholic was the largest one. There were several Catholics in my high school class, and I had some discussions with religion with one of them, and she admitted that Catholics lumped everybody else into a term they referred to as non-Catholics. That included Protestants and heathens and everybody else, which she agreed was bad, but that's the way it was. It finally got to the point where she said, well, I believe that your religion is right for you, but it wouldn't be right for me.
So I want to observe something. I want to observe how quickly we explained away race. Which is not to say that the process of othering whichever others were othering, whether that's, you know, whether that's Protestants or you know, Baptists or whichever, you know, however we're gonna divvy it up. That's not to say that those differences don't also matter. But notice how quickly we stepped out of talking about race. The ways that we stepped out of talking about race, I think, I hope anyway, help us talk about race, because they allow us to see the way that those invented differences or magnified differences become a way for us to sort the world. But I think it's also worth asking, Russ, why was your town all white? There were black people in Illinois when you grew up.
Yeah, not in that area.
Yeah, why not?
It was mainly, I don't know. It was mainly a farming community. Nauvoo, Illinois has a river on 3 sides. The river goes around the town, basically. And the side that doesn't have river on it is all farming community. All of European descent. and the no towns of any size anywhere nearby.
So why don't Black people farm?
Well, even back then, it required some capital or the ability to rent land, and I'm sure there were a lot of landowners who would not rent to a Black if they were asked. So it just.
Yeah. So you need a willing landlord.
Yeah.
Or a loan. Mm-hmm. What did we say about Black people getting mortgages?
Redlined, yeah.
And a lot of farms stay in the family. So if you don't come from a family that has one, then you have to have a lot of capital.
And who owned more or less every acre of farmland in the United States until 1865?
I don't know.
Until 1865?
We'll pretend that something changed in 1865.
Slave owners.
Yeah.
White people in general.
White people. And they owned the Black people too. Right. Now, there have been free Black people in North America since shortly after there were enslaved Black people in North America. But the history of what happened after the Civil War, the 30 years or so of what we hopefully called Reconstruction and what became Jim Crow, was a really hopeful attempt to allow some of these newly freed Black Americans to begin farming on land that they might eventually get to own. But then we had a sharecropping system and we had Jim Crow laws that worked really hard and often pretty explicitly to criminalize Blackness. And then we had the 250-year head start that white capital had versus Black capital. And pretty soon, a very small minority of Black people owned any land, and a very small minority of the land was owned by Black people. That didn't take my attitudes to happen, right? I didn't have to vote on whether it would be effectively impossible for Black people to own farmland by not too long after the Civil War. I didn't have to vote on the legal structures that made it difficult for free Black people to come to Iowa and settle. Those happened without me, but they're still there. In order to serve as kind of a protection racket for whiteness. Mm-hmm. Which is why this stuff is so uncomfortable to learn about.
I think there are other ways in which things that amount to racism, whether they look exactly like that or not, are happening. I have two examples. One is that among my white friends, I will occasionally hear, oh, the Asians are going to own it all in two or three generations because they are successful in school. They are successful in raising and keeping capital. And of course, the same thing is said about the Jews. Oh, they're going to own it all because they're so good with money. The other thing that I was taught was from a friend, a client actually, who became a friend, who was from Bangladesh. And he was not poor. His family was, I would suppose, by Bangladeshi standards, wealthy, but at least they were well enough off. But he, and he had a couple of doctorates and good jobs and all the attributes you would think would go with suburban whiteness in Des Moines, Iowa. But he said, oh, it's just an everyday thing that those of us who are Bangladeshi, and I think by that he might have meant South Asian, always have to watch out where we are and keep in our places. And he told me some overt things happened and some that were less overt, just like I would hear from Black folks. I don't think it's the Blackness. There, people find a way to be discriminatory about anything that even looks racial.
John, was your Bangladeshi friend here in Des Moines?
Yes.
Did he experience these things?
Yes.
Okay.
He had also lived in Canada for a while and said that wasn't much different.
So yes, racism is not only a white versus Black dynamic. It's certainly not only an attitude dynamic. And so racism exists in all of these different ways. And the ways that, the ways that anti-Asian sentiment is expressed and is institutionalized, and the ways that that different groups from within Asia are segregated and racialized in some ways that are not necessarily obvious from the perspective of whiteness, from the perspective of sort of the dominant racial place that we have. And so the assumptions that we make of Koreans, Japanese, Chinese, there's a broad set of assumptions that are sort of culturally made. There's a broad set of assumptions about Southeast Asians, a broad set of assumptions about South Asians. That's about as far as we can sort of, we whiteness can sort of, that's as refined as our discrimination gets in a lot of cases. But you can recognize some of those same differences, and some of those differences are structural racism just as anti-Black structural racism is. They may be different patterns, right? They may be different things about, who was allowed to come to the country, who is taken seriously in which kinds of jobs, who has which kinds of access to education. And so those pieces are complicated too. Go ahead, Pam.
I was going to say, it just seems like, when you're in a comfortable society and things are going along, and then you get in this new group and things change and make you uncomfortable and they're a threat to you, and you're not, maybe don't understand why, but I remember my mom, who grew up in Shenandoah, Iowa, said a Black family came there, and she said they didn't last very long because people just didn't know what to do with them, or, it was kind of a threat to them, but she didn't know why. But I mean, you could say that with race or religion or anything else, people get nervous about, different things going on that maybe disrupt their lives.
Yeah. We have this really interesting ability as white people, particularly those of us who grew up in more or less all white settings, we have this really interesting ability to be super threatened by races that we have never, ever encountered. in a way that in a way that we wouldn't necessarily be the same kind of threatened by, oh, they, you know, that family is Russian Orthodox and they practice a different flavor of Christianity than I'm used to. Because we have been carefully taught these racial filters.
Yeah.
And you know what race we don't filter in any interesting self-conscious way? We don't filter white. We have this understanding of what it means, or what it means to us that someone would be black, or what it means to us that someone would be Asian, or what it means to us that someone would be Hispanic. We don't spend a lot of time thinking about what it means to us that someone would be white.
Do we put ourselves, as all of us are white here, put ourselves into groups based on our nationalities, though? No. I'm German and Polish. You're Swedish. You're, you know, a little bit of that.
What do folks think? What were folks' experiences with different European nationalities? In the places you grew up.
It may be different because Germany is a special case, I'm not sure it is a special case, but my mother emigrated from Germany in 1924, and I never saw much about this. But I eventually figured out or learned or was told that it was just not nice to be German after World War I. And the immigrants, as rapidly as they could and as publicly as they could, what's the word? They learned English, but that isn't what I'm trying to say.
Assimilated?
Assimilated. Thank you. That's the word.
They hid the
Yeah. And I would
Yeah.
I would suppose that's true of other whites, but I don't know that because at that time the U.S. hadn't been at war with other countries so much as Germany, but I'll bet you it was the same. We all know that the Irish were put down for 100 years in New England until they could establish enough wealth and enough numbers to be accepted, and I'm anxious to hear other stories here, but I'll bet you that it's, again, natural, even for tribes of us white folks to divide into sub-tribes.
Other experiences of diverse European nationalities.
I would say growing up, I don't have a clue what anybody else in town, what their background was. And, I mean, even now, I couldn't tell you what any of you guys are, so I don't necessarily think we group according to nationality. And it's not something you see by looking at someone, where if someone is black or Asian, you can categorize them.
I remember it used to be talked about that, I can't think of his name, but it was a Hispanic name, common Hispanic name, like Gomez or something. But the father in the family went by Blackie because he was indeed much darker skinned than most Hispanic people. I think they counted themselves as Mexican, and I don't know why his skin was a different color, but they managed to fit in somehow. Their kids were accepted even though they were Catholic and brown, but again, I don't know why. They were the exception to the rule, and I wish I knew why.
And probably a piece of the why is that word assimilation, which is kind of how whiteness works. And so the thing that I would argue, and I'm following others who have made this argument already, but what I would offer is that at the same time as Zurara back in the 14th century, or the 1400s, 14th or 15th century anyway, at the same time that he was inventing race, what he was doing was specifically inventing blackness and whiteness, so that they could be in a relationship like this. And part of what whiteness does, and part of how whiteness has functioned in the United States particularly, has been to assimilate this group of white people as this sort of, you know, we had the language of melting pot, you know, when in your social studies classes, the idea that we all came from some, you know, we all came from various somewheres, as long as those various somewheres were Northern Europe, were okay. You know, but there was a rhetorical and legal process where the Italian immigrants to the United States eventually, over a few generations, became kind of undifferentiated white. And the Irish, you mentioned the Irish, a very similar sort of rhetorical and legal process where now, you know, everybody's a little Irish on St. Patrick's Day, right? Like that's sort of that's the level at which we think about Irish identity. Where Irish this was especially kind of around the turn of the 20th century, Irish and Italian were talked about with the same language that we use to talk about other races. We don't think about it that way anymore, because this assimilationist project has worked, right? And so what are they now? Oh, they're just white. And so you'll have pockets of sort of national, sort of old world national pride. You know, you'll have the little Swedish town, or the little Czech town, or the little pockets of a given, you know, in a larger town, the little pockets of where people were from back in the old country. And they've intermarried by now anyway, but that's all sort of, that blurring, even the thing where I could say they've all intermarried by now anyway, like white people and black people and Korean people and Indian people haven't also intermarried, right? But we have been carefully taught to know that those differences make a difference. And, you know, the difference between, you know, are they from Germany or are they from Spain back in the old country, that's not a difference that makes a difference. We're all just white. So whiteness is doing something in this, you know, in this structure of racism. Whiteness is kind of at the center of this structure of racism. And the ways that what it means to be black are sort of invented in our minds, or the ways that what it means to be black are written into our maps. That's in some of the materials that came to you this morning. Those outcomes are written in a way that kind of functions to preserve whiteness as this other thing. I don't necessarily have anywhere to go with that other than to, at least, you know, as a like powerful conclusion. But as we go through this equity challenge, let's bear in mind what whiteness is doing in this. Because we're going to talk a lot about the racial imbalances, the racial inequities. But there's a race at the center of this that is easy for us because it's us. It's easy for us to forget to talk about it.
Nathan, I got one quick story here. I don't know if you're about to wrap up or not, but let me just throw out a period where I had a little white on white discrimination. And Russ, you may be able to relate to this, but as I indicated, I was in Marshall County, sometimes in the town of Marshalltown, K through second grade, then moved to the farm, which took me to a one-room country school for 4 years. And there was a lot of school consolidations going on in the 50s and early 60s. And when the country kids had consolidated and decided to come to town, they picked us up in a nice yellow school bus and hauled us right to the school door. And some of those cold winter days where we're in a warm bus and I'm waving at some of the city kids that are walking to school, there were some, what should we say, farm kids versus town kid, I can't think of the right word. I was more comfortable with dating girls from the farm than city girls, and a lot of my friends were also from the farm and in 4-H. I had more common interests with them. But the good news is that was seventh grade. I hit town school in seventh grade, and oh my God, I didn't think I was going to survive it. You know, I mean, one room country school was a little more casual as far as academic standards. But by the time I got to high school, see, with just a couple of years, but like say, my seventh grade was kind of a we had two groups, city kids and country kids, and we all looked alike. Well, fortunately, I knew some of them through Sunday school, and I had gone K first and second grade. But like I say, my seventh grade was just enough things going on. It was not a pleasant year for me, but it had a happy ending. And just to take that one step further, even when I ended up at Drake draws heavy from Chicago area. Deb, you know how they recruit. I too found myself more drawn and more comfortable with girls from central Iowa than dating somebody from Chicago. And in sociology, there's a name for that. You are comfortable with people that were raised within about 100-mile radius of where you were raised. And that proved out at Drake. My dad was, well, Claudia was from Nevada, of course, and Marshalltown, Nevada, all that. Yeah, I dated some girls that were not just Iowa girls, but you just back to who you're comfortable with. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that in, that seventh grade, there was two factions in Marshalltown Central Junior High, the country kids and the city kids. And it took a couple of years. And then, like I say, but consolidations, that was going on all over. We had a mild case of it. It really split some communities when they shut down their schools. Oh, terrible hard feelings over which school would be consolidated and where the students would physically go to school. Russ, did you have any consolidation in your area? School consolidation?
Turned on here. Okay. Yeah. My first six grades, I went to one-room schools. And then, seventh grade, we went to town.
Did you have any in the city?
What's that?
Did you have any city kid, town kid conflict when you went to town?
I don't remember. I don't remember any conflict. No, they were as I mentioned before, there were a lot of farm kids in the school. Mm-hmm. And but then when we moved to West Des Moines in 75, when I took a job at Drake, and the orientation was conducted by one of the vice presidents, and he mentioned that there were a lot of students from Chicago. He said to an Iowa farmer, Des Moines may be Sin City, but if you live in Chicago, Des Moines is a nice, safe place to send your kid to school.
Yeah.
So the psychology of bias and the ways that we picture whatever those differences are, that's a fascinating science. That's day three. So if you want to go back, that was Wednesday. And the understanding how bias works as a cognitive thing, part of how bias works is that it gives us a better ability to sort of notice differences within our group versus noticing differences within a group that we have set up on the outside of us. Some of that is going to be in the ways that, to the extent that we did know, whose old world national origin was which, we could say, the Norwegians and the Germans, they're different and they've got different kinds of meatballs. But other than that, like, they're pretty much the same, right? Like, we can see the difference. We can recognize the difference, but it really doesn't matter. Where when we look at an out-group, and this is, again, like, this is psychologically tested. If you look at an out-group, whether it's, town kids and city kids, once you've grown those groups together, then there's some other out-group, right? The kids from Story City or whatever. Those people in that out-group, they're all the same. You find this actually in white people have generally, and the more insularly white we were raised, we have generally a harder time differentiating between faces of Black people. So recognizing, oh, that's Ibram Kendi, and oh, that is Chanjurai, and I can't remember Chanjurai's last name, but that's Ibram, that's Chanjurai, I can tell them apart. That's harder to do when you are looking across one of those in-group, out-group lines. Now, that in-group, out-group line doesn't have to be a race line, right? It can be just as present in the ways that we look at people across any other group, but that there's so much built across that race differentiation that it's real, even though it doesn't biologically exist. So we have to keep sort of coming back to that. And part of what that difference does is that creates whiteness as a thing. It creates whiteness as a thing where I can look at John and I can look at some other white man with gray hair and a beard and a hairline back here wearing a blue shirt and tell them apart, because we're in the same group in the same way that I can do that within whiteness. Those implicit biases make it harder for us, or the implicit biases are an artifact of how it's harder for us to do that across, not just across racial differences, because remember, racial differences are constructed, right? But across other kinds of differences too. But they are also there across those racial differences. That's part of how, as they said, the measurable outcomes are different between in things like policing, in things like hiring, in things like education. Some of those can be sort of measurably connected to implicit biases within whoever has the power, the teacher, the cop, the lender. But actually not everything can be attributed to those implicit biases. There are other structural factors at work too. So we have to know about those, and we have to know that there's more than just what's going on in our brain. So this next week, we're going to talk about some really measurable pieces. The themes this week really are kind of about wealth and housing. So what access do you have to money? What access do you have to housing? Not only like what's the quality of the housing, what's the location of the housing, how is it that that wealth and housing as measurable material things, how is it that those are racially determined? So that's what we're going to learn about this week. And it's going to be really hard for us to sort of psychologize our way out of this week. So any questions before we sign off for another week of great learning?
One thing I might mention, are we on?
Yep, you're on.
Let's see, I think. Okay. Many years ago, at Covenant, occasionally they'd have a program of sorts, something happening after church. And Susie Thompson volunteered to show some photos of her home country, Korea, South Korea, and talk about the different things. So she started off showing slides and talking about the people in there, relatives and friends and places and so on, switched to a different reel of slides, and again, soon she put in a new reel and said, "Oh, those people I don't recognize." Went to another slide and it kept going, and says, "No, I don't know them either." And finally she said, "You people are right. All Koreans do look alike."
And it is, we found that it's possible to, it is possible to change this part of your brain that has an in-group and an out-group. So we had sort of a running joke with a couple of other families with Asian kids. One family had four Korean adoptees. One, the dad was, can't remember where in Southeast Asia his family was from, but so there were a number of us who, at our kids' Taekwondo class, all had East Asian kids. And we would watch the white kids in the class and try to figure out who was who. And we would get lost sometimes because, of course, they're all in uniforms too. But we would joke with each other, "I don't know, I can't tell these white people apart." And, you know, of course, if we worked at it, we could.
I took my kids to Northwest Aquatic Center, and my girlfriend, I was trying to find Jessica's best friend, and I found my kids because they had black hair. It was right. Easy out of all those sandy toe-headed little kids, you know. And my girlfriend said, "What does Susie look like?" And I looked at her without even thinking and said, I don't know. All those sandy hair colored people look alike. And she just started laughing. I'm like, okay, it's true. And I don't think when I look at Asian people that they look alike. So my brain has changed because it used to be that I thought all Asian people look alike and all Black people looked alike, and they don't. They really don't.
They really don't. Yeah.
And no, it is, they really don't.
If you go take that implicit bias test on day three, if you take that implicit bias test at the end, they will recommend ways that you can train some of the implicit bias out. And part of it is practicing recognizing faces and practicing differentiating faces from each other. So it's not easy by any means. You're changing something that, you know, that happens in your brain before you've even realized it. But it is a way of actually sort of reshaping what your in-group is versus what your out-group is. So there are ways to work on this. So that'll be, those will be some of the questions that I think we'll want to ask too, as we continue dealing with this stuff. How do we want to work on this? And how do we white people want to work on this? Okay, learn a bunch about wealth and housing this week. Come back next Monday at 7:00. Same bat time, same bat channel. Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.